accession number 18191, reel 5.
John Allam, reel 3. Right, John, the Mark II Victor, then. Perhaps you could tell me a bit about it.
Yes, first of all, it's probably worth recording that it was rather a different aeroplane from the Mark I. Fuselage stayed the same. There were minor mods on the tail end of it, but the major aerodynamic mod, of course, was the stretch of the wings. They increased the wingspan 10 feet. This was done by an 18-inch insert each side inboard between fuselage and wing, pushing the wing out, and another 3'6" on each wingtip, making a total of 10 feet for the whole thing. The object, of course, was that we were looking for even more altitude than we were getting out of the Mark I's. The next thing, of course, was an increase of power. The Victor had always, in its Mark I days, been short of power by comparison with the Vulcan, which needed about 14,000 pound thrust engines to drive it, whereas we only had 11,000 pound thrust engines to achieve virtually the same results. But with the Mark II, first of all, we had Conway 11s fitted, which gave, I think it was 17,000 pounds of thrust each, which was a big improvement. But the definitive engine was the Conway 17, giving 20,500 pounds of thrust each. So the aeroplane had a total of 82,000 pounds of thrust, which was quite a lot of power.
You've got quite a lot of extra range, presumably, having bypass engines for the first time.
No, we didn't get a lot of extra range out of it. There was more, but it wasn't really significant. The aeroplane always had the edge range-wise over the Vulcan, and had what probably 17,000 miles. Just what are we talking about? 1,700 miles. Range with
radius of action.
Yes, radius of action. Mm. It really wasn't vastly improved with the standard fuel carried in a B2, because when it became a tanker and the fuel quantities were stepped up, that was a different story altogether. Mm. So those were the major changes that. There were also other very important changes. The electrical system, which had been a very good system on the Mark I, was a DC system, basically. But because of that, it had to carry an enormous number of batteries to provide backup for flying power unit control in the event of a total failure, which was always a consideration, total electrical failure. With power controls, you had to have some backup because you couldn't fly it without power, and electrical power was required for the signaling of the wretched things, and of course hydraulic power to actually actuate them.
Was the reversion to DC that standby facility then?
Well, on the Mark,
you had battery backup.
On the Mark I, it was an all DC aeroplane, and so you had enormous battery backup to run the aeroplane in the event of failure. When it came to the Mark II, to to reduce weight very largely, we went to an all AC system. Of course, you can't store AC, and so some other form of backup had to be provided, and this was provided by having two things called ram air turbines, which were situated in the top of the fuselage, well aft, one on either side of the center line of the fuselage, just forward of the fin. And these things had scoops, which were normally closed in flight because you didn't want the drag that they would generate throughout normal flight. In the event of total failure of either electrical system, and the Victor's electrical systems were split into two, port system and starboard system, and quite separate. The two port engines ran the port system electrics, and the two starboard engines ran the starboard electrics. And one system could run the whole aeroplane. Now, to back this up, in the event of failure, the Ramair turbines cut in automatically if you got total failure on either side. And immediately they came into action, they picked up the flying controls so that you transferred to them without a hiccup as far as flying the aeroplane was concerned. They also picked up a few other vital systems like flight instruments so that you could still maintain attitude and fly the aeroplane in the event of being in instrument conditions. Now, this backup was only sufficient to allow the aeroplane to commence a descent and fly downwards. You had to keep speed. You became a glider if you got total electrical failure. But you could control it. And the main object of the... Well, let's go just say... the only real reason for total electrical failure would be total power failure of the engines. And so the purpose of this thing was to allow you to descend to levels where you could relight the engines, because it was really four-engine flameout that we were guarding against, and this was expected to be a possibility the pressure wave coming from an atomic explosion or a nuclear explosion on the back end of the aeroplane as it tried to disappear from the scene.
And that would put your engines out, would it?
Well, it was, in the early days, it was considered possible that it would put the engines out, and it was considered that you could get a four-engine flame out just like that. Now, so the purpose of the Ramair turbines was to provide a safeguard so that you could control the aeroplane and fly to lower altitudes where you could relight your engines. Because if you were bombing from, say, 55,000 feet, you couldn't relight at that height, and you had to come down to 40,000 feet to relight.
You need a minimum amount of air then, too.
Well, it was interesting. In fact, with the Conway 11s, you could relight at 55,000 feet. They were absolutely superb. The engines had caused some trouble in the early days when they were first fitted, but when those problems were sorted out, the Conway 11 was one of the best jet engines I've ever flown. It was superb. You could do anything with it up to any height. You could slam accelerate it. You could just thump the power levers forward and it would accept the situation because its control system looked after it for you. You could just thump them and the engines would pick up as fast as they could without any problem. If you flamed them out at 55,000 feet, let them get cold, you could relight them at 55,000 feet. But the 17s, when they came, wouldn't do that. They were still very, very good, but one of the things they wouldn't do was to relight as high as 55,000 feet. And you had to come down to 40,000 feet, and it was absolutely critical. At about 40,500 feet, they wouldn't light. At 40,000 feet, zoink, they'd light every time.
Did they pinpoint why there was a difference between these two engines?
No. I don't think anybody ever really considered it very serious. I can't remember any real work being done on it. It would probably involve a lot of work anyway. And basically the safeguard was there in terms of the Ramair turbine systems to back the aeroplane up for just that possibility. So that was basically electrical system. Other things that happened with the Mark II, it picked up the Smith's military flight system, which was, of course, a much more advanced flight director system, which we hadn't had before. We were flying on ordinary artificial horizons with the Mark I's and pretty basic instrumentation. Well, basic by today's standards, that is. The military flight system came along as one of the early flight systems, and we had that, and that was absolutely excellent. There were two military flight systems, one for the co-pilot, one for the first pilot, and they had comparators, and if at any time they disagreed with each other, an indicator would tell you that you had a disagreement between the flight systems, and you could check on basic instruments to see which one of the two you were subsequently.
So, I mean, they had computers for the first time, didn't they?
Well, we were getting computers now, of course. Oh, absolutely, yes.
And how was the readout any different? I mean, you still had your Artificial Horizon and ASI and everything else, didn't you?
Yes, of course, ASIs were
barometric.
Were basic, and altimeters were basic, of course, too, really. I mean, they were being improved all down the line. But it was basically the attitude and heading and direction indication that became so much better with the military flight systems. And
of course, you went into inertial navigators in those days, were you?
No, we didn't. Just let me think. I don't think we had inertial navigators at that time. They came later, though, on the aeroplanes, but probably by when they'd been in service for a while. The other thing about the military flight system was that it was hooked up to the autopilot so that you could operate the autopilot through the flight system rather than operate the autopilot independently and manually, which was an enormous advantage. You could gear it in and simply by selecting a new heading on the new desired heading on the flight director, have the autopilot follow it for you. You didn't have to do anything else about it. And, height locks and all these things appeared on the scene. You could fly to an altitude, have a height lock set, and the aeroplane would level out at the...
What year are we talking about when all this was happening? Late 60s, or...?
Well, it was early, it was late... No, come on, late 50s. We flew the aeroplane in 1959, and it was all in it from the beginning, you see. So the research and work had all been going on for some years before that to get this lot going. It was coming along extraordinarily quickly, really. Yes. 1959, we did the first Mark II flight, and all this stuff was in it from the beginning. Mm. Another thing that it had from the beginning, in addition to having, of course, yaw dampers and Mark trimmers, they put in roll dampers. Because it was going to operate at higher altitudes, it was considered right away that roll dampers might be necessary. And yes, I suppose they improved the...
Do you want to have a swig of coffee?
Yeah, hold on for a minute.
A bit of a rumble.
Yes, you're
right. Okay, roll dampers.
Yes. Yeah. So the roll damper, although perhaps not absolutely essential... certainly made the aeroplane a much, much more stable platform at 55,000 feet than it probably would have been without. With the result, well, that it became, apart from a very good bomber from that height, a super aeroplane for photo reconnaissance. And at 55,000 feet, one aeroplane could sweep the Mediterranean from one end to the other and photograph everything in the Mediterranean. In one go, provided the weather was clear all the way, which mostly it is in the Med. So that became very useful. I think those are the...
It was pretty steady in turbulence as well, was it? It had a very...
Well, yes. I mean, all aeroplanes are going to move about a bit in turbulence, but all these aids iron this problem out as much as they possibly can. But, of course, when you're talking about those sort of heights, there is... very little turbulence at 55,000 feet. I don't know whether you ever really get it. Once you're above about 35 to 40,000 feet, you're out of turbulence too. You can get some nasty turbulence from, say, 40,000 feet downwards, cobblestone type sort of stuff in particular. But I can't really remember having turbulence at 50,000 feet and above at all. It's just absolutely calm.
Now, after the Gary Powers incident, I know the Valiant and the Vulcan were stressed for low-level operation. Was the Victor also given that treatment?
Yes, it had the same treatment too. Well, when you say it's stressed for it, they try to get away without doing it, and it caused it just worked the fatigue problem up furiously for all of them, for that matter, and so they were being returned for... crack detection and all this sort of thing over and over. I suppose up to a point the Victor escaped from it by being converted to a tanker at the appropriate moment in time. and as a result saved its life in terms of fatigue and resulted in it going on for years and years.
What was the sort of average airframe lifetime when it came to the point of being converted and left its proper role?
I can't tell you the answer to that. It comes out in fatigue units, and I think it's really better to talk from someone from the Air Force. They know all these things off pat because they were watching them the whole time. They used to add the fatigue units all down the line, and they knew exactly when an aeroplane was going to have to be taken out of service, really. When they finally took them out of service, a lot of them still had a moderate amount of fatigue life left in them. But by having said all that, by civil standards, these military aeroplanes never have the same sort of life as a civil aeroplane, anything like, in any way.
We were talking about fatigue units.
Fatigue life for military aeroplanes is short by comparison with civil aeroplanes, but I'm not an authority on fatigue life, I regret. Mm.
Now, the crash of the prototype B-2 was pretty dramatic, wasn't it? It disappeared over the Irish Sea.
Yes.
Remember that day, presumably.
Yes, we never really considered it a prototype. I suppose it was. It was the first Mark II anyway. And we first flew it about the date was the 20th of February, 1959. And despite having spending rather a lot of time on engine development in its very early flight days, we had some compressor surge problems, which took a bit of sorting out. But once we had got that sorted out, that aeroplane worked extraordinarily well. The new AC electrical system, reliability-wise, was excellent, and all its systems were good. And for flight test purposes, we really ploughed along very well. By the end of July, we were knocking 100 hours of flight test work, which might not sound very much, but when you consider that the first prototype, Victor, which had been flying for, 18 months, hadn't achieved 100 hours when it crashed, you can understand the difference. But we got a lot out of that 100 hours on the first Mark II Victor, and I flew it throughout. I had other Handley Page test pilots with me, and I didn't always fly in the left seat the whole time because I wanted to convert other pilots so in the event of me suddenly being ill or anything, someone didn't have to start cold on the wretched thing again. But I had flown in that aeroplane on every flight up until it went to Boscombe Down. And during the last 2 to 3 months of its flying, that was in midsummer that year, two Boscombe Down test pilots flew with me a fair bit as well to become accustomed to the aeroplane, checked out. They were both ex-Mark I Victor pilots. They knew the Victor anyway. And they flew with me. And when we eventually took it to Boscombe, I can't remember the exact dates, end of July, early August, I believe, that year.
It was 59.
I did final checkouts with the pilots at Boscombe, circuits and landings and that sort of thing. And then the aeroplane was on the ground for a few days while they did certain instrumentation things they wanted, which were extra to the things it already had. And eventually it flew with the two pilots on board that had been flying it and didn't come back from its first flight. And there was no indication of what had happened. Nobody knew anything. There'd been no, as far as we could tell at that time, there'd been no radio calls. At first, they couldn't find any traces on radar to show what might have happened. And the whole thing was an utter mystery to the extent that it was even wondered if the thing had been taken east across the Iron Curtain. This is one of the considerations. It's hard to believe it was possible, but it was thought about because there was absolutely no evidence, and it was several days before there was any evidence. And the first evidence that came, I believe I'm right in saying, it's a long time ago, but I believe I'm right in saying, came from the skipper of a fishing vessel somewhere, which was fishing somewhere south of Ireland, who reported that he'd heard supersonic bangs and seen an enormous splash in the sea. Well, this prompted a new line of investigation altogether, and eventually some radar traces were found by looking back over recorded radar information, and these radar traces ended up in such a position that it could have coincided, could have been put together with the splash that appeared in the sea. And so a search was commenced, and this was set in place. I don't know, trawlers were used, and they dragged the seabed in the area and eventually found the remains of the aeroplane. What they I forget how much they got back, 80% probably of the aeroplane came back, all the engines came back, and some parts of all of the aeroplane came back. So much so that they were able to say it hadn't broken up in flight and hadn't lost any major components. Something of everything was there. And so it was decided that it had hit the sea in one piece. Subsequent calculations reckoned that it was supersonic down to about 8,000 feet, which is going some by anybody's standards. And basically, the whole thing was much of a mystery. Various things in particular that came out of it were that at that time, there was no evidence of any radio call from anybody on board the aeroplane. Absolute silence. I forget, there was very, very little to go on.
It didn't carry a flight recorder.
I can't remember in those days. I can't believe we didn't. I would have thought so, but I'm not absolutely sure. But I suppose we didn't have flight recorders other than the normal flight test recorders, of course. There'd be plenty of that on it. But the state of that probably was pretty useless, I imagine.
Now, these two pilots, they were Boscombe Down trained test pilots.
They were both TPS trained. They were both been on B Squadron in Boscombe Down. They'd both been Mark 1 Victor pilots at Boscombe Down. They'd both flown with me not an unreasonable amount in the Mark 2.
So they wouldn't have done anything silly?
I can't believe that they would have done anything silly. It's hard to imagine. The findings, the official findings of the Board of Inquiry, came to the conclusion that the starboard pitot head, which was a pitot-static head, in fact, had departed from the aeroplane whilst it was at about 52,000 feet. And that particular pitot head fed data to what is called the flight data unit. And it was decided that as a result of this information suddenly being lost by the flight data unit, they got a Mark Trimmer runaway, nose down, which it was claimed pushed the nose down, made the aeroplane supersonic, and the pilots were unable to recover from it. Well, now, from my previous experience with that actual aeroplane, I find it quite impossible to believe that as an answer, because apart from having done Mark Trimmer runaway tests, I had one occasion when I had an unexpected nose-down Mark Trimmer runaway in it, which was triggered by one of the observers switching a switch to see what would happen if he switched it, and it was intended to give Mark Trimmer nose-down runaways, and he just did this while I was doing some other thing, and so I got an entirely unexpected Mark Trimmer runaway. Now, the Mark Trimmer actuator is a very, very slow device. It operates very slowly, and if it runs away, either nose up or nose down, a pilot flying the aeroplane will immediately detect a problem and react to it and contain the whole thing.
And you can disengage it.
You, apart from being able to disengage it, you can contain the thing. It only has about 2 degrees of operation over the elevator anyway, command over the elevator. And you can utterly contain the thing. And it's hard for me to believe that that could possibly be the cause of the thing. But anyhow, that was considered the final cause of the accident.
Yes, you were telling me earlier on, I don't think we were recording at the time, the characteristic of the Victor, that it would go nose down at about Mach 0.8 something and then recover.
Well, yes, this was standard. The markdown, a nose down trim started at about 0.83 and continued somewhere up to about 0.93 and subsequently recovered and the whole aeroplane became stable again. And the faster it went, the more nose up it wanted to go, which is standard. And so to make it go faster, you had to push anyway. So you had, it wouldn't just go supersonic by itself. You had to make it go deliberately.
Could there have been a contaminated oxygen supply and the crew were disabled?
Well, that is a possibility. If the oxygen was contaminated or someone had fed in refilled with air or something other than oxygen, then okay, you could have had a crew which was unconscious, which would account for no radio calls. It would account for the fact that the engines were still at max continuous power when it hit the sea. The air brakes were in when it hit the sea. I can't believe pilots who were conscious of what was going on could sit there with full power on, while the aeroplane was supersonic, leave the air brakes closed and let this situation continue. It's just impossible to believe.
What angle did it hit the sea at?
It's pretty steep, apparently. Yes, it's pretty steep. I don't know for sure. I don't know. The Board of Inquiry information is probably available now, and it would probably be recorded.
I'd be interested to look it up at the PRO if it's
been
launched there.
Yes.
Because, I mean, normally accidents of that kind are usually sort of deep stalls.
Well,
they're finding it all the way down, and they would have put out a radio.
But if it had been a deep stall, you wouldn't have been supersonic
or any of that sort of thing.
And you'd have had a lot of time to be able to talk about it before you got there.
And you can hop out.
That's right, too. You'd have had, a deep stall from that sort of height. Even the rear crew would have got out with plenty of time to go, and the pilots on their bang seats and so on. Mm. But you see, the whole crew was in the aeroplane when it hit.
Yeah, extraordinary.
Yeah.
And were the bodies recovered? Could they?
Oh, yes. Yes, they weren't in any very, very good shape.
No.
One of the things that was recovered was the co-pilot's wristwatch was with its hands impacted onto the face.
Mm.
And they knew a lot of other things because nearly all the instruments had hands impacted onto the faces of them, and for instance all the electrical system instruments indicated that the electrical system was in perfect state. Everything was impacted to exactly the position it should be in. They couldn't find any system failure on the aeroplane at all.
Now they spent a lot of money and time getting all the wreckage up.
Mm-hmm.
They never came to any conclusion apart from this pitot attachment you were talking about, and it didn't affect the introduction into service of the B-2?
Well, no. What happened was, of course, they were deadly scared that there was a problem which we hadn't discovered in the first 100 hours of flying the aeroplane, and so a whole new trial was set up to try and find out what might have happened. And the new trial consisted of mostly of work at 55,000 feet, mostly doing what we call buffet boundary turns, investigating the buffet thresholds of the aeroplane, because that was what was being investigated by Boscombe Down when this thing sparked off. I mean, they were doing it at 52,000 feet, not 55.